I knew that it would be provocative for a woman to sing so explicitly about sex, so I intended that. I did not realize how the sexual aspects would eclipse any discussion of anything else.
Indie rocker Liz Phair sets the record straight on The Frame Weekend, and we find out the secret to Adam Driver's short but prolific acting career.
I just don't take it for granted that we're making a movie, and someone's paying a lot of money for us to be here right now to do this thing that will last forever. You know, why take that for granted? Why show up and kind of wing it?
Adam Driver's character might have killed off Han Solo in Star Wars, but in his next movie, he's got a more important battle, saving his marriage. And why has China declared war on the series South Park? It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is impacted by the wider world. A little later, the Icelandic composer for Joker talks about writing creepy music for a creepy character. But we're going to start with a conversation I had with actor Adam Driver at the Telluride Film Festival.
Welcome to the stage, Adam Driver.
He was at the festival for Noah Baumbach's new movie, Marriage Story.
If we have succeeded, we have a special guest.
He was presented with a career honor, a medallion, if you want to be exact, by this guy.
Director Martin Scorsese.
What you see before you is a great actor, a great screen presence, truly, I gotta say it, one of the finest, if not the finest of his generation. Thank you.
I don't know how we follow Marty, but we're going to try. Looking at just the selected roles that we saw in your reel, it's impossible to categorize them. But I'm wondering if there's a common denominator, even though the roles are really different, when you see a script or hear an idea and how it strikes you, and if there's a common reaction you have when you know this is something you want to do.
Well, it's a director's medium, so mostly the director is what I kind of first think of, because sometimes I don't understand the character, but I trust that maybe over time, hopefully before we start shooting, that something will come to me. But there is definitely a moment, and it's different in every movie, when either it be the first time I read it, or sadly, sometimes when it's over, where...
Where you figure it out.
Right. Where you kind of when you get that. And that made sense to me, too, also, like, because I came from a theater background, and you do a play for 5 months, and, you know, 8 shows a week, and suddenly the last performance always like, oh, if I could do it now I feel like I have a better understanding. But obviously you don't, you know, that's not how movies work.
When you read something and you hear the character speak to you, and then you get on set, and maybe the director is hearing the character speak in a different way.
Yeah.
Is that hard to divorce yourself from how you have heard that voice speaking to you?
Yeah, you quit. No. You quit. You just leave. Especially if it's Marty. No. Absolutely not. I feel like I've learned to not have a right answer about going on set. Like, I've learned to try to do as much research as you can, but I try not to have an idea that I impose on a set, because I always feel that closes me off to other choices. Like, you do your homework and do your research, but then show up and then have to be prepared that 6 months is down the drain. Because, you know, you never took into consideration the door opens out, you know, or that your partner's drunk, or that, you know, I mean, that doesn't happen often, but there's just all, or just someone has a better idea, right. And you have to take ego out of it and be like, you know, the most important thing is the thing overall, not my journey. It's not my job to have a feeling all the time. It's the audience's job to have a feeling. So why limit yourself by coming in with an idea that you're trying to impose on the other actors in the scene? And often I feel like the scene finds it out. Like, it's not all one thing, I guess, to answer your question.
How do you navigate your way as an actor who might have a certain way of working when the directors and maybe your fellow actors have different ways of working? How do you find the ground on which you're most comfortable and where you think you can act the most competently?
That's a good question, because it evolves with every person. So, and some directors, they're such visual storytellers that they, it's really hard for them to articulate what it is that they want from you, and that's fine. It's just a different way. Like Soderbergh, for example, will shoot things incredibly fast, and one or two takes. We had to do this scene in this movie called Logan Lucky, where I had to drive a car into a convenience store, and he's like, "Do you want to do it?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Well, we'll do it, but we'll only get to do it once." So then you start to get like, "Yeah, it's totally fine," until they start counting down, like, you know, 10, 9, and the money and time that would we'd lose if, you know, if it had gone wrong really starts to enter into your mind, and then that's it. Then we did it once, and that was the only. But all of the scenes were kind of like that. And by the time you break for lunch, you've shot everything for the day. So, you know, it goes incredibly fast. And then there's other people that will shoot, you know, 14, 16 hours a day. You know, I've just learned to adjust. It's kind of similar to what I was just saying. The more you try to control something that's uncontrollable, then the more it's less fun.
You were recently doing Burn This. I'm wondering, when you're doing a play and then going into film or television, what are the things that you might miss but retain as an actor who's doing a show in front of a different audience every night when you're not able to replicate that on a film set?
Yeah, it's a totally different thing. It's working with Noah, for example, he likes to do a lot of takes, and that actually feels more familiar to working on a play because, you know, it's like a whole run of a rehearsal, you know, truncated into a day, you know, which is, I think, rare with someone like Noah. And you're also rehearsing, you know, if you can, as much as you can before you start, just being prepared to give yourself time to explore all the options. And when you don't do that with, like, a Soderbergh, then I tend to have regret, you know, of, like, you can't help but go home and imagine, oh, I had all these ideas that now... But then again, maybe those were bad ideas that were just... So I don't know anything. This tribute is a sham.
Couple last things. When you work with directors that you worked with before, like Noah or Jim Jarmusch, what does that give you in terms of familiarity? Obviously, you like the way they work as filmmakers, but what does it mean practically in terms of what you do, the conversations you have? How does it evolve when you're somebody that you've done multiple films with?
I could answer that for a long time, especially about those two people, Jim Jarmusch and Noah. Yeah, I've worked with Noah four times. This is the fourth time. And there's just something that our way of working, our work ethic is similar. I just don't take it for granted that we're making a movie. And someone's paying a lot of money for us to be here right now for this amount of time to do this thing that will last forever. Why take that for granted? Why show up and kind of wing it? And finding people that have your same work ethic, that's a rare thing, I think. I just repeated myself three times.
No, you did not.
That's the best one.
Show of hands, how many people are in Telluride for the Adam Driver double feature, Marriage Story and The Report? Wow, okay, that's about half the house. I'm gonna ask you a quick question without spoiling either film. I want to ask you about Dan Jones and the CIA's post 9/11 detention and interrogation program, which a lot of people would call torture. They called it extreme rendition and other things.
Right.
What would you say about that film going into it without giving it away, about why that movie spoke to you and why you thought it was something you wanted to do?
I mean, the topic was something that I, you know, embarrassingly didn't know anything about. And I mean, the original report is over 6,000 pages. The redacted version is just over 500, and our script was, you know, 130. How do you tell that story as economically as possible, but not without leaving the humanity out of it? So that all of those things just seemed an opportunity to bring a topic to light that has been in the dark, and that I was inspired by that. You hope there's people like that in a room alone, mm-hmm. toiling away for 6 years, you know, with no support, you know, trying to make a difference, and all those reasons why I liked and wanted to do it.
But here's something where you can make a difference, and it is Arts and Armed Forces, which is
for
the organization that you do with your wife, Joanne Tucker. For people who don't know, what is it, and why does it matter?
Joanne Tucker, my wife, and I started this nonprofit when we were second-year students at Juilliard, because I had just come from the Marine Corps, and I had noticed a change in myself that suddenly I was able to, through theater, you know, articulate a feeling that I didn't have the language for, because it wasn't really part of my, you know, growing up in Indiana. Not a slight to Indiana, but it just wasn't the theatrical hub of the world. So, still not. You know, we decided to create a project where we just brought theater. Initially, it was just theater to a military audience. to kind of show the commonality between, you know, the military and artistic community, and there actually isn't such a divide. You know, you have a group of people trying to accomplish a mission bigger than any one person. You have someone who's leading it, and when they know what they're doing, it feels like makes what you're doing necessary and relevant, and when they don't, it feels like a waste of time and dangerous, and you're forced to be intimate with people in a short amount of time. We take a play to a base and we read it, and then we talk about it afterwards. No sets or costumes, no lights, and the response is pretty incredible. You know, it's like you're at the forefront of watching someone experience a new art form. They're like, oh, this is what play is. I never could afford it before. It wasn't accessible to me. I didn't know theater was like that. I've been trying to express that, and now I can. Anyway, that's what we'd be doing. Thank you.
Last question. I think there are a lot of things that different people will take away from Marriage Story. What was the thing that you treasure about making this film with Noah and Scarlett?
Again, that could be a long answer that I know I should keep short. I mean, this movie is hard to talk about because it's very personal, and it was personal to all the people who made it collectively. And we talked about it, you know, a couple years before we started, you know, making it. And those conversations of what it's about or what were we trying to do are still happening, you know, but how love can transition and how that can be a violent, not physically violent, but an internal violent thing, you know, of you know someone kinetically where, you know, it's everything, your way you were in a room or where you are together is second nature, then suddenly to divorce that, you know, from yourself, that could be painful, but maybe it's just transitioning into something different. And I thought that was a beautiful idea.
Adam, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Brent. Thank you.
That conversation with Adam Driver was recorded in front of a live audience at the Telluride Film Festival. His movies Marriage Story and The Report both open in theaters next month. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
And live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
Saturday Night Live has gotten a lot of attention for weekly roast of Donald Trump and his administration. But Washington Post pop culture and television reporter Bethany Butler highlighted a different subject that's been getting the SNL treatment.
I think that the show is being a little bit daring and edgy and exploring stereotypes and sort of our inherent biases and expectations when it comes to race. You know, I wrote in particular about a sketch called Midday News.
This is the morning. And welcome back to WANU Midday News.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that skit. The people in the skit are the guest host, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and SNL cast members Kenan Thompson, Ego Wodum, Chris Redd, and Alex Moffat. And they're playing daytime TV news anchors, and they find themselves in a competition about what race some perpetrators of crimes might be. So what was it about that sketch that you think was so effective and worked so well for SNL?
Well, I think to start, when the sketch started, we didn't really know what it was going to be. So it's kind of this fun twist. You know, it's when Phoebe Waller-Bridge is reading this first crime report, and it's about someone who robbed a gas station. And when she starts talking about the perpetrator, who police believe is a white man, Kenan Thompson and Ego Wodum, the two black anchors, audibly celebrate, and they're really excited.
The suspect, described as a white male.
Woo, love it!
And then eventually the white anchors also get into this game of trying to anticipate what race these criminals will be, and usually they have their expectations subverted.
Smith is said to have been operating a multi-billion-dollar Ponzi scheme.
Now, you know black people ain't got that kind of money.
He was arrested this morning in Boca Raton. And look at that. He's black.
Really? What?
I think that's what's, you know, smart about this sketch, because it also subverts viewers' expectations and kind of calls us out a little bit. It makes us think, and it's hilarious.
We're talking with Bethany Butler, a pop culture and TV reporter at The Washington Post. I want to ask you about hiring. It does feel like the show is hiring more people of color and women, not only as performers, but also as writers. And do you think that is changing the kinds of comedy the show is doing?
I do. I think it's really apparent when you watch the show now that there is diversity both backstage and on screen. You know, a lot of the conversation about SNL diversity, and I think it's probably happened more in the show's, you know, 4-decade-plus history. But recently, it was in 2014 when people started talking about how the show did not have any Black women comedians on. And I think it had been about 7 years since Maya Rudolph left the show that, you know, they had even made a concerted effort to hire a Black woman to be a member of the cast. And Lorne Michaels, the show's longtime executive producer, pledged to hire a Black woman comedian. They hired Sasheer Zamata. But certainly, you know, the conversations about SNL and its overall lack of diversity have not stopped. So this year they also hired Bowen Yang.
Yeah, well, I'm running tariffs, so this is my time. I'm having my moment. I'm basically the Lizzo of China right now. And turns out I'm 100% that trade daddy.
She's a featured player and, you know, the show has very visibly had very few members of Asian American descent, and people were really excited about his hiring. I think that there is a lesson in some of SNL's racial comedy that, you know, you can do really insightful humor around race, but it can't, you know, target a specific racial group. You can't use racial slurs just, you know, it seems kind of for the sake of it. I think you have to be really thoughtful and you have to know what your goal is in the sketch or routine that you're doing.
Bethany Butler is a pop culture and TV reporter at The Washington Post. She's the author of the column, "The Best SNL Sketches in the Trump Era Aren't About Politics, They're About Race." Bethany, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, indie rocker Liz Phair was misunderstood because of her sex-positive lyrics. Now she's setting the record straight with a new memoir.
I have never found it served anyone to answer the question, what is this song about? Every single time I explain what I think it's about, it disappoints whoever I'm speaking with.
Liz Phair, coming up next on The Frame Weekend. We'll be right back. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. It's safe to say that a lot of us were rattled by the deaths of Prince and David Bowie in 2016. But not everyone was so moved to face their own mortality and put down what they wanted to say before they were no longer alive. Well, not all of us are Liz Phair. The indie rocker burst onto the scene in 1993 with her debut album, Exile in Guyville. And now she has a new memoir.
Hi, John. How are you?
It's titled Horror Stories, and it was released this week. We reached Liz Phair in a studio in New York. You talk in the prologue to Horror Stories about a phone call between your manager and yourself following the death of Prince. And I'm wondering how that call served as a catalyst for writing what you wrote.
It was a very funny phone conversation, a unique conversation where he kind of challenged me in a way I wasn't expecting. You know, I didn't think of myself as old, but he was like, Liz, you know, none of us know how long we've got. You know, you don't know. Are you going to be here tomorrow? You don't know. Is what you're making right now what you would want to leave behind if it was the last thing you ever did? And it just shook me up because I suddenly thought, like, no, I have more to say. I have more to say that I would like to say. And that's sort of when I started writing.
Because very early in the book, you wrote, and I'm quoting yourself back to yourself, you say, I'm trusting you with my deepest self. And I'm wondering if you think you can be more honest as a writer than you are as a musician.
In a way, obviously, you have more room to explain a situation, get more granular with it, and really sort of muse about the unanswered questions. I think that was maybe the most fun thing about the prose writing is that I can wrestle with a problem that I can't find a solution to, and I can wrestle with it page after page, and it's interesting, but it doesn't resolve. And I think with a song, you kind of have to resolve it and kind of say, like, doo-doo, here's what I'm setting up. Here's what's happening, and here's what your takeaway is.
I'm going to play a bit of a song from your first record. This song is called F***ing Run.
I woke up alarmed. I didn't know where I was at first, just that I woke up in your arms. And almost immediately I felt sorry because I didn't think this.
You write in the book, everybody thinks this song is about sex, and on one level it is, but it's also about these moments when real connection and feeling is abandoned in favor of self-preservation. And it got me thinking about the way an artist sees his or her songs and the way an audience does and where they align and when they don't and what that's like, that occasional disconnect.
I mean, I have never found it served anyone to answer the question that is commonly asked of me, what is this song about? Every single time I explain what I think it's about, it disappoints whoever I'm speaking with.
They
get really
sad.
They have this whole idea of what they want it to be about. And for them, if that is what it is about, that is what it is about. It really isn't mine anymore. And I know that's a cliche. Everyone says that, oh, I send it off into the world. They're like my children, but I let them go. I don't think of my songs as my children, but I also don't think of them as mine once they're completed. Once a song has been recorded properly, it ceases to be mine. It can be created by me, but it belongs to everybody at that point in a weird way.
There's a chapter in this book called Hashtag, and there's a lot going on in it, but I want to ask you about a couple of things. And one is that you write, being female in the entertainment industry can sometimes feel like running a never-ending gauntlet of horny dudes. If you think I invited that kind of interest after I published sexually frank lyrics, you'd have gotten the cause and effect flipped. And then you write on the same page, they can't make you an object, I reasoned, if you are adamantly and vociferously the subject of your own sexuality. So that's what you believed, but then other people saw you in a different light based on what you were singing about. So what is your takeaway from how you wanted to be seen and how people interpreted what you were trying to say?
That's a very good question. I think that never quite resolves for me. I saw it. I knew what I was doing. I knew that it would be provocative for a woman to sing so explicitly about sex. So I intended that, certainly. I did not realize how the sexual aspects would eclipse any discussion of anything else, or how that would be picked up in a headline and sort of amplified. I thought of it as rightfully a part of my personality. And there was a lot of song. I mean, there were 18 songs on Exile in Guyville, and I would say at least 15 aren't really about sex per se. They may have dynamics that involve that, but they're not like explicitly sexual. And I think, again, why is this culture so comfortable with violence and so uncomfortable with sexuality? Why is that? It's weird. It doesn't seem healthy to me psychologically.
We're talking with Liz Phair about her new book, Horror Stories.
What a pretty life you have. Oh boy, it's a pretty life you have. And I would need a map just so I could navigate the backyard. Home is very...
You write in almost kind of an offhand way about the propositions that you got, mostly from record label executives, including somebody who's like, I'll pay you $5,000 a month to be my live-in concubine. You're like, I make twice that amount on the road. And yet it seems so casual. It seems like this is the thing that any woman has to deal with on a daily basis.
I'm sorry to tell you, but that's the truth. Like, this is what seems so weird to me, is how many men are unaware of what women's lives are like, especially and most particularly if you step out of your lane, if you dare to live a life that isn't one of the prescribed and approved of roles for women, you're basically fair game. And that hurts. That feels bad. That's not a positive thing. And I think I wrote that chapter in the end to kind of just say the point is not all the separate things that happened. The point is I don't want to have to feel like I'm guarding my sexuality behind like a defensive wall just to grow up and be mature and have sexual relationships. I would like a world in which I can do both. I can be intelligent and safe and still have sex. That's pretty much all I want.
I'm going to ask you one last question. I think you have a teenage son. Is that right?
Well, he's 22.
Okay. So if you have a young son, I have a 19-year-old son. I will tell you, he's not listening to Liz Phair right now, but he's listening to a lot of hip hop. And I'm curious, when you hear teenage kids, maybe your own, listening to music that is, maybe it's complicated, but maybe it's ultimately a little misogynistic. What are the conversations that you have as a parent about musical taste? Because it's really tricky for me, and I'm wondering how you navigate that.
Where it came up in our household, because my son, he's into pretty, his stuff is more like synth wave. He's into that kind of like 80s revival. Or no, I'm going to get in trouble if I say that. I can't speak for what he likes. I do know he introduced me to synth wave, but I am not authorized to speak on his behalf. But I think with porn and stuff, I did try to tell my son, like, that doesn't feel good to a woman, okay? Like, you need to know that. You need to know that, like, when you're physically with another person, that it's a different thing than what you're watching, you know? In the same way that you go to a movie, you wouldn't just, like, shoot someone or flip your car. I did spend some time explaining the difference and the importance of the difference between porn and real connection.
So you may not listen to hip-hop with your son, but you watch porn with your son? Is that the takeaway?
No. Oh, no, I can't. I was not one of those monitoring mothers that, like, you know, made sure he could only see this, that, and the other thing. I kept pretty good track of it for a while. And then when he hit, like, adolescence, there was just no stopping it. So I just tried to work on the character and the brain. I think I did okay. He's pretty great.
Liz Phair's new book is called Horror Stories. Liz, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The Joaquin Phoenix movie Joker has been polarizing for its portrayal of mental illness and gun violence, but it's also clearly drawing audiences to the multiplex. The film has grossed nearly $300 million worldwide. Among the parts that make the film so compelling and also unsettling is its score. It comes from an Icelandic composer who recently shared her process for Joker with The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett.
My name is Hildur Guðnadóttir, and I am the cellist and composer for the film Joker. I experience music very physically. As I read the script, I have a kind of physical reaction to the story, and it was kind of very focused on the chest area and the hand movements. And then they used a lot of the music whilst they were shooting, and it was just, there was one scene in particular that was just incredible to see how Joaquin, without us talking about it at all, like I had no dialogue with him about it, but he did exactly the same movements that I was feeling as I, you know, wrote the original themes. It was just such a magical process. I thought it was really important to kind of feel like we were like in his head, and it's really close to him. It's all kind of his inner landscape, basically the music. It doesn't really underscore much, but it's just like really kind of present as his inner character. And that's kind of what I was trying to do with the instrumentation of, like, in the beginning of the film, it's almost like you're listening just to one instrument playing. But at the same time, there's this kind of huge energy. Like, there's actually like 100 people playing these, like, some of these melodies, but you can almost not hear them. They're almost like this kind of hidden energy that's like his aggression. And the feeling of this kind of underlying something is about to kind of burst from out of the from out of the shadows, and just like, it was hard to have like 100 people like not just playing on full blast all the time, because you're like, whoa. So it was a bit of a constraint for people basically not to play and not to make any sound. So it was like really interesting energy in the room. The themes kind of, you know, stay largely the same, but the orchestration and the, you know, and the size and the scope and the kind of heaviness of the music just kind of gets larger as he's kind of, you know, just the getting more frustrated and more aggressive, and then in the end he just like explodes. Well, to me, it felt a bit like when you're stuck in the same tracks and you're just like, you know, you're just like, oh, I'm trying to get there, oh, I'm trying to get there, oh, I'm trying to, oh, you're still kind of doing the same movement, or you're kind of really just getting more and more frustrated, but you don't really move anywhere. So that's kind of what I experienced with him. I was just like, oh, turn, you know. I wasn't there for the very beginning of the shooting, but I came to the set, you know, just to say hello and you know, just to kind of, you know, catch a glimpse of the set. And they had been listening to the same pieces of music like again and again and again for, yeah, probably 2 months at this time. And I actually didn't know that they had been playing the music the whole time. So I kind of arrived and I'm kind of like, you know, walking with the walls because I didn't want to disturb anyone. And then Todd introduced me to everyone, and I just got this like massive, massively warm welcome. Like, oh my God, it's the composer! And I was like, well, how did they know? So I would have expected them to be sick of it, but they were still pretty happy to see me, seemingly so.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking.
That was Joker composer and cellist Hildur Gunadottir. She also won an Emmy recently for the score on HBO's Chernobyl.
If you smile through your fear and sorrow.
After a short break, a recent episode of South Park so annoyed the government of China, they essentially made the show vanish from inside the country.
Who here thought they had permission to say anything critical of Chinese politics?
Well, it is true, sir. The Chinese seem to exploit their own people with forced labor.
Shut the f*** up, Thor! You're here to flex and not think!
China goes to war with South Park, plus Parasite filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. That's all coming up next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Over South Park's almost 300 episodes, show creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone have taken on pretty much everything. No institution, or government, or country is safe from its satire. Who could forget this ditty from the 1999 South Park movie, probably the only song from it we can run on the air.
They're not even a real country anyway.
This past week, they went after China. The episode is titled Banned in China, that's B-A-N-D, but you can read into it what you want, and it takes on, among other things, how Hollywood panders to the massive Chinese entertainment market.
I can't do it anymore, you guys. I can't even think with the Chinese government censoring everything I write.
So there's not going to be a biopic movie for us?
It's so wrong, you know? I mean, we live in a time where the only movies that us American kids go see are ones that are approved by China. Yeah, it's like China is the new MPAA.
Ryan Parker wrote about the China South Park controversy for The Hollywood Reporter.
South Park has been pretty much banned in the country, and all references to South Park have been scrubbed from any online sites. Basically, from everything we know, if you search for South Park, you're not going to get any information. And apparently all the streaming services have also ceased carrying any of the episodes and any of the clips. So it's almost as though South Park all of a sudden doesn't exist.
There's this great phrase in the law. It's a Latin phrase called re ipso loquitur, which means the facts speak for themselves. And I have to say, the fact that Chinese censors are blocking South Park pretty much validates the whole point of the episode, doesn't it?
It would sure appear to be that way. I think that Matt and Trey were definitely making a point, or numerous points, rather, when they did this episode, both about how Hollywood and some studios tailor their art to fit the Chinese censors so that they can obviously make money there, but also the abhorrent conditions that the work camps in China, or what people who are in those work camps in China, the abhorrent conditions that they have to go through.
I want to play a little cut from the episode here. This is a scene which may have caught the eye of some Chinese censors. In this bit, a very angry Mickey Mouse, who might also be Disney head Bob Iger, is chastising a room full of Disney and Marvel characters.
Which one of you decided to go and start bad-mouthing the Chinese government? Who here thought they had permission to say anything critical of Chinese politics?
Well, it is true, sir. The Chinese seem to exploit their own people with forced labor.
Shut the f*** up, Thor! You're here to flex and not think!
I would say there's a fair amount in the Banned in China episode that Chinese censors could be a little bit angry about. If you were to kind of pick a couple of examples, what would you cite?
Well, I think that the Winnie the Pooh reference definitely did not go over well. I think that's been well reported that that's a huge issue there. And then the way in which the work camps were portrayed were in the abhorrent conditions that those in prison there had to go through, and was also probably did not go over well.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh, I think in some circles has been compared to the appearance of President Xi, and Winnie the Pooh essentially vanished from a lot of social media sites in China. Is that right?
That sure seems to be the case from everything that I've seen reported, and that apparently is what Matt and Trey, the creators of South Park, thought too, and that's one of the reasons why Randy, when he gets put into a work camp, runs into Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, and they explain exactly what's happening in the news, which is far from the first time that Matt and Trey have used South Park and real-world events and news and worked it into the storyline. So, you know, they're getting their laughs, but they're also teaching a few things that maybe some folks aren't aware of.
So there have been a couple run-ins with China recently. One is the NBA, and the NBA has apologized because of what it called an inappropriate comment by the general manager of the Houston Rockets, who sent out a tweet in support of Hong Kong's democracy movement. Matt and Trey have come out with a slightly different statement. What did they say in response to the controversy?
Well, they went right for it, which they usually tend to do, lean in, and they said, like, quote, like the NBA, we welcome the Chinese censors into our homes and into our hearts, in part. And basically what they were saying in this full apology is that money is more important than freedom and democracy. So they definitely were leaning in and taking a shot with this faux apology, and I can't imagine this will be the last we hear of it. I wouldn't be surprised if there was something in this week's episode. I don't know necessarily, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if this is the last we hear of it from them.
Ryan Parker is a senior staff writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The movie Parasite, directed and co-written by Bong Joon-ho, hits theaters this weekend. It's been highly anticipated ever since winning the top prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival.
The Palme d'Or goes to...
Revient à...
Parasite of Bong Joon-ho.
Parasite is a dark but often funny Korean drama about two families, one rich, one poor, and the very bad things that happen when they come together. Bong Joon-ho is a funny guy with a cult following here in the States. His other movies include Snowpiercer and Okja. And over Labor Day weekend, I sat outside with him and his translator Sharon Choi at the Telluride Film Festival.
Crazy.
Look at that.
I'm shouting to the people. And movie is very boring, so please
Don't waste your time.
Across the street, people were lining up to see the North American premiere of Parasite.
Do you ever go in with an audience and watch a film just to see how they react?
한국에서 한번 이렇게 모자 이렇게 싹 가가지고.
So I actually did go to a theater in Korea once. I wore a hat and I was very sneaky about it. And I watched the film amongst the audience and it was a very fun experience. I got to see their responses immediately and I felt a sense of pleasure from it.
그리고 나 자신이 이렇게 옆에 관객한테 내가
And I also felt this compulsion to almost spoil the story for the audience sitting next to me as well.
I want to ask you about Parasite because my understanding is you originally wrote it for theater and not for film. Is that right?
So it wasn't as if I wrote the script for a theater production, per se. I originally came up with the idea, toying with how it would be to put two houses on stage, and that was how the idea began. But I quickly realized that film is the right medium for me. And so from the very first beginning, I wrote the script for the screen.
So when you say two houses on top of each other, kind of upstairs, downstairs, does that mean the idea for this movie comes to you visually first, that maybe the rich family is up here and the poor family is down there, and then you fill in the story? Do you see it first before you start to write it?
이미 시나리오 쓸 때 공간들의 구조에 대해서 많이 설계를 했어요.
So because I'm a writer and director, even from the script writing stage, I already had all the structures of the spaces in mind. They were already pre-designed as I was writing the script. And for Snowpiercer, the class was divided with the tail cars and the front cars. And with this film, I wanted to align different classes vertically.
I'll just jump in here. In his 2013 film Snowpiercer, Bong Joon-ho created this dystopia on a train where the haves and the have-nots are clearly separated by the front and back of the train. And at one point, a character played by Tilda Swinton visits the unruly class in the back and lays down the law.
Order is the barrier that holds back the frozen death. We must all of us on this train of life remain in our allotted station. We must each of us occupy our preordained particular position.
In Parasite, the divisions are defined not by train cars, but by real estate, how nice your home is, and in Korea, whether or not your place has a basement.
In Korea, compared to homes in the States, basements are very rare, and I think basements provide a lot of layers that you can't quite always predict. I think when poor people look at rich people, you always get a sense that we don't know everything about the rich. For poor families, everything seems to be exposed, but there's this lack of information that you feel regarding rich people. You always feel like there are secrets and layers to them that we can never discover.
We're talking with director Bong Joon-ho about his new film Parasite outdoors at the Telluride Film Festival. The poor family in Parasite are pretending to be people they're not. And part of the joke is they're better at doing those things than maybe the people this rich family would hire in terms of tutoring, in terms of driving. They're better than the people they would have ordinarily brought into their lives. They're totally qualified.
예리한 지적이에요. 그들이 사실 사지가 멀쩡해요.
That's a very sharp point because they're actually very properly normal and capable people. They're smart and they're capable, but despite that, they still don't have jobs. And I think that's the sad part about economic inequality all over the world these days. It's not that they're dumb and stupid that they don't have jobs.
When I think about Parasite, I think about The Host, I think about Snowpiercer, I think about Okja. There are so many fantastical elements to all of those films, and they're difficult to categorize, and yet they all seem to be about real-world issues. They can be about consumption, they can be about class struggle, they can be about families. Do you find, as a storyteller, that sometimes the more extreme a story becomes, the more real it can play?
내가 정치적인 영화를 만들어야 된다, 또는 무슨
So it's not as if I intend to make a particularly political film with propaganda. My effort is always to delve into the really mundane, small, daily issues that surround me. But once I delve into those issues, I find myself ending up in a dark cave of capitalism. And so it doesn't happen because I wanted to, but I just end up dealing with those issues.
My goal is always making funny movie.
Sharon Choi and Bong Joon-ho, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you.
Parasite is South Korea's official Academy Award submission for the Foreign Language Oscar. It's in theaters now. To wrap up the Frame Weekend, we're going to visit an art exhibit that's focused on walls. While President Trump has consistently made clear that a wall along the U.S. southern border is one of his top priorities, a new exhibit at the Annenberg Space for Photography looks at walls in all their forms, both physical and figurative. Jen Sudol-Edwards curated the show. It's called Walls, Defend, Divide, and the Divine. It includes the work of some 70 artists who photograph barriers around the world. When you first enter the exhibit in Century City, you're immersed in a sonic and visual installation.
You're basically looking down at the water coming in, the breakers hitting the shore, and it's incredibly beautiful and so peaceful and so just the Zen state. And you have this line cutting down the center, which looks like any pier that you would see at any boardwalk. But then slowly as the camera pulls away, you realize that this is in fact the strip of the wall that divides the United States from Mexico, cutting into the Pacific Ocean down near San Diego.
What were the first conversations you had about this show? What was going on in the world, and how did it start coming together?
So Katie Hollander, the director, is a very old friend and colleague. She was really excited about the 30th anniversary of the Berlin Wall coming down.
This November?
Yeah, November 9th. It's also the 50th anniversary of the British government putting up the peace lines in Northern Ireland. And there was, 2 years ago, a lot of discussion about starting to take those peace walls, the peace lines, down in 2023. So we're about to celebrate the Berlin Wall coming down.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. Reporting tonight from Berlin.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go. Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant.
That was a huge thing. And growing up in the 80s, with U2 being one of my favorite bands, like Northern Ireland and the Troubles and the walls defining Northern Ireland was also a big part of my life. So the fact that these two conversations, celebrations, were so much a part of the international conversation going on, but then we also had this gearing up of build that wall and Donald Trump's campaign and the whole idea of further militarizing the border of the U.S. and Mexico, there was this weird disconnect. And so Katie was really interested in that tension between celebrating this moment when we were saying walls are not useful, they're damaging to society, they're damaging to a psyche, but then this international urging for more walls to be going up.
We're talking with Jen Sudol-Edwards at the Annenberg Space for Photography. And walls, like art, can mean different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And as you were finishing up the installation of the show, the New York Times came out with a story about Donald Trump's ideas for the wall.
He wanted the wall electrified, with spikes on top that could pierce human flesh.
The New York Times reports that privately, the president had often talked about fortifying a border wall with a water-filled trench stocked with snakes or alligators.
I'm going to quote from the story. After publicly suggesting that soldiers shoot migrants if they threw rocks, the president backed off when his staff told him that was illegal. So even as you have put together the show, the conversations around the wall have certainly changed dramatically in the intervening 2.5 years, haven't they?
The urgency of the exhibition absolutely ramped up over the last 2 years, but it also made, I mean, I'll speak for myself. It made me more anxious to make sure that the show was as powerful, but also as thoughtfully provocative as possible, because I really did want to make sure that we had a balance of all continents, of as many time periods as possible, of as many motivations as possible, so that people would, again, like, take a moment to think about, why do we do this? That the anxiety to build these walls has been going on for as long as there's been human civilization, but to what purpose? And as we're getting so anxious, not just in this country, but internationally, I mean, a third of the nation states of the world now have barriers on their borders. That's extraordinary. It's not just a U.S. issue. And so this is a phenomenon that's in the international zeitgeist. How is humanity going to continue all of this broad globalization and internationalism that the internet has introduced into our lives and travel when we're so manically every month seeming to want to define our territories more and more?
Jen Sudell Edwards is the curator of Walls, Defend, Divide, and the Divine. It's at the Annenberg Space for Photography in Century City through December 29th. And that's our show for today. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Grova, and Julia Paskin. Valentina Rivera is our engineer, Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend, and join us back here for the daily version of The Frame on Monday.